morning, Mr. Covington. Good morning, Ms. Campbell.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Covington, whenever you're ready.
I think I'm ready, Your Honor.
Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
How about 3 minutes, Your Honor?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. I'm James Covington. I represent Vincent Gonzalez in this appeal. He was convicted on his pleas to one count of possession with intent to distribute cocaine and one count of possession of a firearm while in position with intent to distribute. He received a total of 11 years with 10 years suspended. And as the court's, I'm sure, aware, in connection with his plea agreement, the plea was conditional so that he would be allowed to pursue an appeal from the trial court's denial of his motion to suppress. I will note, Your Honor, that he did receive an appeal bond, so he isn't incarcerated at the moment. Just briefly, this is a case in which police officers of Norfolk Police Department responded to a local hospital based on a report by a spouse that she had been assaulted by her husband in their vehicle. She described the situation to Officer Benson, who arrived at the hospital. She also told him that in the house where they resided on Fenton Avenue in Norfolk, that there was cocaine and marijuana and a pistol. Based on
what the wife said to the officer at the hospital, is that probable cause to arrest him for family assault?
Your Honor, we have counsel in the trial court asserted that that was not probable cause, and I've pursued that avenue. That's pretty thin evidence based solely upon her description of the events that she was assaulted.
If the trial court believed what she said at the hospital, wouldn't he be convicted of family assault?
Quite likely, Your Honor. Okay. I would agree with that. And so, based upon that, Officer Benson went to the house where she said they resided with the intention of making an arrest. While he was en route, he called for backup. Two other officers arrived. When they arrived, Officer Benson knocked on the door. Mr. Gonzalez came to the door. After a very brief exchange, he arrested Mr. Gonzalez, handcuffed him, searched him, Mirandized him. The other officers who had arrived had apparently gone out into the yard around the house to sort of inspect the exterior of the house. Rather than the arrest being completed at that point and Mr. Gonzalez being taken immediately to jail, the fact that he didn't have shoes on caused the officers to inquire about whether he wanted them to go in and get some shoes. He initially indicated that his shoes were right inside the door. Officer Johnson or Officer Benson looked right inside the doorway and it wasn't there. Then he indicated that they asked if he wanted to get them to get him some shoes. He said his testimony at the suppression hearing was that he told them that he didn't want the shoes, that the jailhouse had slippers, and that he could go directly to jail. The trial court did not buy that and went with the officer's testimony. They asked him if he wanted some shoes, that he said okay. Officer Johnson asked if he could go get the shoes himself in the brother's room where Mr. Gonzalez said that they would be located. Mr. Gonzalez said specifically no, he would take him there. So after that, he took off the officer or officers directly to the bedroom where the shoes were found. On cross-examination at suppression hearing, Officer Johnson, who eventually conducted a protective sweep, so he said that Mr. Gonzalez had put the shoes on in the bedroom at the time. That was based upon his contemporary notes that he'd made at the scene saying that he had put the shoes on in the bedroom. Then they had taken him out of the bedroom. They seated him in the dining area or near the dining area on a couch while Officer Benson went outside to make a phone call to Mr. Gonzalez's mother, who he understood to be the owner of the house. Mr. Gonzalez had already denied consent to search the house because he said he didn't live there.
Was that a denial, or was he just passing off the decision, saying that I'm not in a position to consent or deny?
Your Honor, he certainly did not consent. He said he, I was looking at the transcript this morning, his testimony was that he couldn't give consent because he didn't live there. I think that's pretty much what he said.
Does wife's consent make any difference?
Your Honor, the Commonwealth raises that in its brief about the, and that sort of came up the first time as being a significant factor only in the Commonwealth's brief on appeal. I don't think it does make a difference because, and the officers at the scene certainly didn't think it made a difference. The attorneys at the trial level, when they argued this matter, didn't think it made a difference, and the judge who ruled on this didn't think it made a difference. She was at the hospital. She simply said she lived there with her husband and apparently had said, "You have consent to search." But there's no other evidence whatsoever about what her living arrangements were in that house, whether she had any possessory ownership interest in the rest of the house where she didn't live, whether she owned the house, or anything like that. And Officer Benson said clearly on the record that he wasn't ready to proceed with based upon her consent because he wasn't sure who had authority to give assent, consent. So, no, Your Honor, I don't think her consent is an important matter for the court to consider in this. What is important for the court to consider is the order of events and what the trial court considered in its ruling on this issue of suppression. This court is entitled to disregard any factual findings of the trial court, although it gives deference to the factual findings that it finds to be wrong or unsupported by the evidence. Your Honor, the trial court...
I don't think that's the standard. We absolutely defer to factual findings of the trial court if there's evidence to support it.
Your Honor,
we don't second guess the trial court as to whether they should have believed witness A or witness B.
Maybe I misstated that, Judge, in terms of, in cases involving consent, I believe that the courts have said that the factual findings made by that the court gives deference to the factual findings made by the trial court on the issue of consent, but independently decides whether there was evidence to support that finding. And as a general rule, I think, as you indicated, can always disregard evidence that wasn't supported. The fact of the matter is, Your Honor, that in this case, Judge Fulton refers to some in his finding says that the defendant willingly led officers from room to room in search of his shoes, ultimately leading to the discovery in a room in the rear of the house. Given the circumstances of this case, I conclude that it was objectively reasonable for the officers to believe that the consent obtained from the defendant to locate his shoes allowed them to search until they ultimately discovered the shoes. Judge, I have a quotation in my brief, which is from the officer's testimony, in which Officer Johnson said that after being informed by that there were no shoes right inside the door, he asked if his brother, if he could get some shoes. He asked if Mr. Gonzalez wanted us to go into his room, and he said that his brother lived at a location. He would take us to his brother's room to get his shoes, and that's where they were. When you're saying he, you're referring to the defendant. Answer to the defendant, yes, ma'am. Did you go to what the defendant identified as the brother's room? Yes, he led us to a room. You give down a small kitchen to a dining room, and that's where he led us, and then pointed out a pair of shoes for us to get for him. And did you get the pair of shoes for him? Yes, ma'am. And then we went back in the front room and sat him down so he could put them on. That was his initial testimony about putting them on after he's sitting down. But he later on cross-examined says, oh, my notes show, and I agree that must have happened that he put the shoes on while still in the room.
How is that relevant?
Your Honor, I think this is particularly relevant, and I think it's particularly relevant that the trial court didn't consider the sequence of events, because the cases are clear that assuming that Mr. Gonzalez, who was handcuffed, who'd been arrested, and is being asked by the police if we could go in to get him some shoes, can give voluntary consent under those circumstances to go into his house, because I think he figures they're going into his house to get the shoes anyway. The consent that he gives, and the courts are very clear on this, is limited to the object of the search. And in this case, the only thing that they were looking for is the shoes. He had been arrested. The arrest was complete. They were going to take him to jail. The only thing they were going to do is get his shoes.
Counsel, you're close to your rebuttal time, and I'd like to hear you talk about the protective sweep.
Yes, Judge. The protective sweep, to me, and that's what's crucial, is that the timing of this is that he has his shoes on, and there's testimony. The officers are asked a number of times on cross-examination at the suppression hearing if, in fact, the protective sweep wasn't done till after he had his shoes on, and the answer is yes.
But on either set of facts, he had his shoes on at the point in time of the protective sweep, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the thing
then
is...
back to Judge Frank's question. Why does that matter when he put his shoes on? Let's assume he's got his shoes on when the protective sweep occurs.
That goes with the idea that his only consent was to get his shoes to go in the house. If he gave consent, it was only to go get his shoes and leave.
You don't need consent for a protective sweep.
We don't need consent, but there has to be a reasonable, articulable suspicion that there's some danger to the officers in the house. The officer said when he first went in, which is when they would have, when that, doing a protective sweep would have made sense, they didn't do a protective sweep. The officer said it didn't occur to him to do it then. He's gone in, they've got his shoes on. Bowie says that once that's done, the only thing you need to do is complete the arrest and depart the premises. They didn't complete the arrest and depart the premises. They sat him on the couch while Officer Benson went out to check with Mom about getting consent to search the house, which he didn't get. And now that's why the protective sweep is done, and I think to trial counsel below, that it was a pretextual sweep. That the officers manufactured the situation which would create their supposed protective sweep, because they've already completed the arrest. They've done what they did, what was would have been the reason for them going, the only reason for them to be in the house on a warrantless search for anything. They'd completed that. And now, as an afterthought, while they're just sitting there with the shoes on, they decide to do the protective sweep. And I think that's very big, Judge. I mean, I think it's like saying, well, we gave him his Miranda rights right after he made the confession, so it's no big deal. But it is a big deal, because here everything's been done, all as under Bowie. All they need to do, the arrest has been made, all they need to do is depart the premises. But they didn't do that. They hung around and said, oh, by the way, now we need to do a protective sweep, because we're sitting here, he's got his shoes on, and instead of taking him to jail, we're going to go ahead and do this sweep. I know the timing, and I think it's Peyton versus New York that says that in these cases, any deviation, the slightest deviation from the limitations on the consent to search, either physical or temporal, constitute a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And I think we have both a physical and temporal violation of any consent that was given for those officers to be in the house. And the cases are full of the language that in these cases, any search conducted within a house, within a home, where that's done without a warrant, that the Commonwealth bears a heavy burden of proving that it complies with the Fourth Amendment. And here, I think, calling it a protective sweep after everything's been done to complete the arrest, simply doesn't comply with the Fourth Amendment. Maybe if they had said we went in and did a protective sweep. Actually, if you look at the judge's opinion below, what he said was once they were in the house, they conducted a protective sweep and then justified the protective sweep based upon the fact that they had some idea that there was a gun in the house. They did the but they didn't just do it when they walked in. They did it at a point when everything else was been done, and it made no sense to do a protective sweep. In fact, they were looking for evidence, which they found, because they had information that there were drugs and a gun in the house. I see the red light on, Judge. So I think I've probably said my piece for now.
Thank you.
Ms. Campbell, I would like for you to address the protective sweep. The police has to have an articulable basis to support a reasonable suspicion that another person was in the house who could pose a threat to the officer's safety.
Absolutely.
And the trial court said, well, there was a gun in the house coupled with the possibility of others being present. What evidence, if any, would give the officers a reason to believe that someone else was in the house?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the officer testified to this from pages 70 to 74 about how the conflicting information they were getting about whose house this was, who lived there. The victim originally said that she and the defendant lived in this house, but then the defendant indicated, oh no, that's his brother's bedroom. And I don't live here, it's my mom's house, all that conflicting information that the officer was able to...
And what part of that conflicting information would give them reason to believe that someone, in fact, was in the house?
I think they have reasonable suspicion that someone could be in the house based on that information, and I think the specific information that there was a gun in the house raises the level of a security threat to the police officers when they are in that house. So that they have...
They apparently didn't think it was a problem when they first entered because they didn't do a protective sweep then. Did any of the facts change that would then give them the articulable reason?
The officer testified, and I think in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the facts suggest that when they went in, they followed the defendant into the brother's bedroom to retrieve these shoes, at which point he attempted to put them on, and then they actually brought him back into the living room because he was having a hard time. He was in cuffs putting his shoes on, and that's when they sat him down. At that point, the officer realized that one of the officers left, so there was two officers left in the living room, and he realized that they had their backs to a hallway, and he became concerned because he wasn't sure if anyone else was there. The defendant had told them that there was no one else there, but based on his situation, he did not feel like he could trust that information, and based on
the... Is that the standard? Trial court said that... Also had a right to check out as to whether the defendant was telling the truth or not. Is that the standard for protective sweep?
No, Your Honor. Of course, it's an objective standard. However, I think courts are careful to second-guess officers in these situations where it may not be one of your extreme situations, but it's still a situation of officer safety when you have a victim who has testified that this guy definitely has a gun in his house. He's just committed a violent crime against her.
So the standard is then you're entitled to a protective sweep if you think there's a gun in the house.
Your Honor, I think that the standard is if you think that there is a gun in the house and you are unsure whose house that is and who might be living there or hidden in a closet, for officer safety, yes, I think you can.
Counsel, that's inconsistent with Robertson and Megill, isn't it? I mean, isn't the standard that is set in Megill and Robertson a different standard than what you just articulated?
Yes, Your Honor, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself with the circumstances of the case, but I think that this case is very similar to the Williams case that I cited in my brief. And in that case, it is similar because the officers were inside the home.
Yeah, but in Williams, the facts are different. There was a neighbor and the officer, they personally observed that others were inside the house.
Correct, Your Honor. And
how is that applicable to this case?
I understand, Your Honor, that this is a step down from that case, but I was attempting to draw an analogy to that case where, objectively, the officers in the current case could have a reasonable belief that there could be other people in the home.
One of the officers said, I didn't see anybody and I didn't hear anybody.
Correct, Your Honor, which is what makes it different than Williams, where they were.
And is the standard could be, or is the standard reasonable belief that someone is in the house?
Yes, Your Honor, the standard is that there is a reasonable belief that there is someone in the house, which I think that these officers...
Is someone in the house that poses a danger?
Poses a danger to the police officers, which is the crux of what these officers were facing in this situation.
Thank you.
To turn back to the timeline of this, to the other portions, after the officers originally responded to this domestic call, they did have probable cause to arrest the defendant, which is why they went to his house. In brief, the defendant makes an argument that the officers couldn't have arrested him on the curtilage of his home.
Let me interrupt one more. Going back to the protective suite,
absolutely.
I'm sorry. He didn't search the garage.
No, Your Honor, he didn't because
he didn't search the kitchen. He didn't search the bathroom. Mm-hmm. The first room apparently was a child's room. He just opened the door and closed the door without doing a protective sweep there. Am I right on those facts?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that shows that he was doing a protective sweep to do the areas that were immediately apparent and that he felt were faced to the back of his other officer, and therefore that's why he felt like he needed to make sure there was no one that was going to sneak up on them from that direction, and that was the reason he testified to that he only did that side of the house, because that was the side of the house that was immediately apparent and adjacent and that he was concerned about. And I think subjectively those are his reasons, but I think objectively that is reasonable.
Can you do a protective sweep after you've made the arrest, which was the purpose for going to the house?
I think that it depends on the circumstances, and in this case, the timeline, they didn't sit him down and wait 20 minutes, and there's nothing in the record to indicate that they sat him down, waited around 20 minutes, and then did it. It's all happening really quick, that they get his shoes, sit him down. They're having him get his shoes on the couch. When one of the officers leaves, and that officer testified, he leaves and he goes to get the mom on the phone, and before he even finishes the conversation with her, they're already coming back out of the house. So this was happening very quickly. They weren't waiting around trying to come up with reasons to search the house. They were trying to sit him down, get his shoes on.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, clearly they wanted to search the house because one of the officers was out in the police car trying to get permission from the mother.
Correct, Your Honor. And as Judge Atlee asked of the defendant, I think the wife's consent does matter. I think subjectively these officers testified that they didn't think that they had consent and they weren't sure and they were trying to get it. But objectively, the wife testified she lived there and that they could search the home. No one else equivocally revoked that consent. The defendant testified he didn't live there, so he couldn't give them consent.
She specifically gave permission to search the house?
She did. I can give you an app site if you want it. Okay.
Would they have needed a protective sweep if after the defendant put his shoes on, they took him outside and put him in a police car?
No, Your Honor.
And their business was over?
No, Your Honor, because they would not have been in the house. So officer safety wouldn't have been as large of a concern at that point.
Are you saying that her consent matters objectively because she's a co-tenant?
Yes, Your Honor. That's from the objective. I understand that that was not argued below, or the officers did not indicate that, but objectively, she did give consent, and a reasonable officer could have believed that they were able to search the home at that point. I think these officers were trying really hard to do things right and get consent and make sure what they were doing was okay. But I think objectively, at that point in time, they could have searched the house with her consent.
Does when the owner then comes back and say, you don't have consent search, does that in any way vitiate the wife's consent?
Yes, if the owner had said, the owner said that no, you cannot search. And I think there's a little bit of testimony about what he was saying to the mom and what maybe she had said to him, but I'm not sure that's clear from the record. And then turning to, I'm not sure if the court has any issues about entering the home for the shoes. I think the record was clear in the trial court's factual findings that the defendant fully cooperated in leading them to the shoes. The search warrant that came after all of this, after they had seen the scales and the gun and the powdered residue, that was lawfully obtained by probable cause, and as I made in my final section of my brief, the officers had probable cause to search this home from the beginning based on the wife's statements to them that there was drugs and a gun in this home. The officers could have obtained a search warrant at that point in time in order to search the home and would have discovered all of this.
How do we do, in light of the Hassan case, how do we get to inevitable discovery when this was a conditional guilty plea?
Yes, Your Honor. The Hassan case is, I think, significantly different from this case. In Hassan, they were moving to suppress, they were moving to suppress his statements that had to do with a Miranda issue that then led to the evidence being discovered. And that was what was reversed, was the issue of the statements. So therefore, the Commonwealth in that case was arguing, well, the information would have been discovered, but it was the statements, whereas not the sorry, I'm kind of talking circular. But that was different.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But so the Commonwealth would take the position that the Hassan case does not stand for the general proposition that when there's been a conditional guilty plea, you cannot conduct an inevitable discovery analysis.
No, Your Honor. Absolutely. The Hassan case doesn't stand for that at all. It just stands for the fact that when you have a case where some other thing is being suppressed, like his statements and his confession to the evidence, just because the evidence would come in, he gets to go back and now have a trial without those statements, basically.
Because whereas, how do you get to inevitable discovery when there's been no evidence presented because you haven't had the benefit of a trial? There's been a conditional guilty plea, and if there's a reversal and someone's allowed to get rid of or remove their conditional guilty plea, how do you conduct an inevitable discovery analysis when there hasn't been a trial?
Well, you conduct an inevitable discovery analysis because when you're doing an inevitable discovery analysis, you're just saying, well, would this evidence that they are moving to suppress been discovered but for the police officer's conduct? And in this case, it's easy to do that analysis because what they're moving to suppress is the drugs and the scales and the gun. And in this case, you can say, okay, assuming that the police officers acted unlawfully, they had probable cause from the beginning to search that home. Therefore, similar to, I believe, the Helm case I cited in my brief, they would have been able to obtain a search warrant lawfully and search this home. Whereas in Hassan, what you're moving to suppress is statements. And when you can't do an inevitable discovery with that because what you're moving to suppress is just, I'm not articulating this well, but you cannot do an inevitable discovery in that context because you can't say, but for the police misconduct of the state, like, I was on a roll now and I forgot.
No, at least
it's not an easy concept.
Yeah,
Hassan is out there.
Yes. What you're moving to suppress is different than what the evidence is coming to come in. So the analysis isn't easy in that case, but it's just you can't do it in Hassan because what they're moving to suppress is different than the evidence that would come in at trial.
How about Baker that cites Hassan?
I don't believe it stands for that principle in every inevitable discovery case that it would have to go down for the trial court. I mean, this court does inevitable discovery review frequently. And the whole point of a conditional guilty plea is that the only issue is whether or not the Fourth Amendment was violated. And if it wasn't, then he knows what the evidence would have been against him. The only issue in this case is whether or not these drugs were recovered appropriately.
So I guess what happens if we were to reverse the trial court in this case?
If you were to reverse the trial court in this case and find that there was some police misconduct, it would get reversed and it would go back to the trial court on that ruling. And purely speculating, I'm
the Commonwealth would have to evaluate if they had
enough evidence,
enough
what
evidence
they could do
outside what we
know, yes,
say was inappropriate, and then they would make a determination whether to proceed forward.
Correct, Your Honor.
With a trial.
Correct.
And the defendant would be entitled to withdraw his plea.
Right, because, yes. But you can also affirm on inevitable discovery grounds without it needing to go back, because it's...
And do you have a case that specifically involved a guilty plea where that was done?
No, Your Honor, but I would be happy to look for one. And
that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Commonwealth, just ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
Mr. Covington, I know we burned through all of your time before. You got a number of questions. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you'd like to sum up briefly.
Well,
or we may ask you some questions during that minute.
No. Could happen.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm going to start with this one. Your first assignment of error states, trial court erred in denying the defendant's motion to suppress the fruits of his warrantless arrest because the arrest was made without sufficient investigation to establish probable cause. So that assignment of error is limited to whether or not there is probable cause for the arrest.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you're limited to that issue. But then on your brief, when you argue, you don't even mention probable cause for arrest. You talk about the cases about curtilage, arrest out on the porch, the curtilage, and so forth. Where does that leave you?
Well, Your Honor, on that particular issue, it doesn't leave me a whole lot. I don't know that on that issue, as far as the arrest itself, I think that's probably the toughest issue we have in terms of having been raised at the trial court. And I think probably in doing the brief, I just simply sort of incorporated the curtilage concept into the question of probable cause and the arrest.
Your argument doesn't match your question, your assignment of error.
I'll concede that, Judge. I can't improve on what I've done. But I will say, if I could make a brief point, and that is on the Hassan case. It appeared that the court feels that it does deal with the general proposition that if you enter a conditional plea, if you prevail on the suppression issue on appeal, then you're entitled to withdraw your plea under the statute. That as a general proposition. Otherwise, as in Hassan, as in this case, the Commonwealth can always go back and say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't really apply, the statute doesn't really apply the way it sounds like it applies, because we can go back and say there was inevitable discovery, there would have been inevitable discovery of this evidence anyway, a matter which had not been considered by the trial court.
You wouldn't suggest that the court couldn't consider inevitable discovery in the appropriate case. I mean, there's on a case law is replete with cases decided on inevitable discovery.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I mean, in the appropriate case, it certainly could.
So makes this case inappropriate?
Well, I would say, first of all, Judge, I think the trial court could consider inevitable discovery. And this court could, I think, under the circumstances where it was clear from the record that there was inevitable discovery, although I don't think there is in this case. Maybe I'm not getting the question, but I think Hassan says under these circumstances, my view is that when there's a conditional plea, you really can't go to the issue of inevitable discovery to get around the conditional plea. That if you prevail on the major issue with regard to the suppression issue, whether it's a statement or whether it's drugs or whatever, if you prevail on that issue, you're entitled to withdraw your plea under the statute. And this court is not entitled to go back and say, well, wait a minute, we can now consider inevitable discovery anyway. I think that's what the sign is saying. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's what the court case is saying. As to other matters, I think the court has probably asked questions and gotten its answers on those to its satisfaction. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel, and then we will resume by taking up the Thorn case.
All right.